Testament.
All right. Welcome, everybody. This is the Bottom Line Business Show. I am Joe Danier. I am your host. We talk about things that are happening with business. And my overall hope is to maybe talk some of you off of the sidelines to get something started, affect the marketplace, have your big ideas, and have a system and know what to do with them. You know, when I first started in business, we had some success. And, you know, early on. And so the observers were kind of like, you know, what are you doing? How are you putting this together? And so I started sitting down with people early on and kind of looked to see what they were doing, comparing what I was doing and finding differences. And that's helpful when you do comparative analysis. You know, even if I was doing things accidentally, when I compared to see what other people were doing, you know, I can see that my mind made a difference where theirs may have been stunting their growth. I did want to announce last week, I mentioned that we had a sale of one of our portfolios, and I didn't release any of the names because I wanted the new owner to have the first ability to do a press release and do that before I went publicly. That's just a consideration on their part. But now the sale is done and they've done their press release. The company was Freshmade 3D, and you've heard me over the years talk about that on the technology show. This was an original Youngstown Business Incubator portfolio company. And so what they did was they invented a process. You know, we're all looking in the practical exercise of new 3D printing technologies where everybody kind of knows that you can print things in that plastic and make figurines and maybe little demonstration units. But you having something and produced completely in plastic, plastic kind of been nailed as being – you know, there are cheaper ways to manufacture high volume stuff. So it's sort of like dabbling. Like everybody has these plastic ones and they're producing stuff, but it's not like sellable and there's a really narrow space in the marketplace. Well, Freshmade 3D invented a process where you take sand and you create a material like a building material or a harder like a rock or a concrete type of material from a 3D printer. And so over the years, they've developed applications and testing and market research and trying to apply it in a whole bunch of different ways. They approached myself and an investment company that I'm a partner in, Mahoning Valley Business Alliance. And maybe I think 2018 was when we bought in. Might have been end of 17, beginning of 2018. So we bought in and met with them pretty regularly about directions that we wanted to take and which one of the avenues that they were exploring have the most potential. And for the most part, they really started ramping up their production abilities. They had really great an order book that seemed to be always, you know, the pipeline that was always seemed to be filled. They were doing really well. And one of their suppliers, which was X1, and they actually they actually manufacture the machines that the materials were actually being printed in. So it made sense that this was a great, you know, partnership. And there was an offer to acquire and went through the whole process of acquisition. And now X1 owns the assets, intellectual property of Freshmade 3D. So that is a big win for our area. I love when we see something that started downtown, Youngstown Business Incubator, grows up here, gets supported by the community, you know, scales to the point where it either branches out and scales into its own or it is a good candidate for an acquisition. And in this case, that's exactly what it is. So lots of kudos for YBI and what they brought to the table, X1, seeing this the potential in this product that was created, and then the guys at Freshmade 3D that had years and years and years of product development, and they busted their butt to get this product going. So very proud of them. So now we're the Mahoning Valley Business Alliance we kind of freed up that investment capital, and I'm kind of starting to entertain who's going to fill the spot in our portfolio to invest in next. There will always be someone in that spot. When I give attention like that, it's sort of like a permanent thing until it becomes what it's going to. It stays on my shelf. But anyway, started interviewing some potential candidates that will be the next generation. But I will always sit down with any of you who may have a business idea and want to know what's next. I was asked this week, and it was really a profound question, is like, if you get all these opportunities, how do you know which ones to take and which ones to turn down? And I'd never really had to answer that question. I kind of knew how I did it, but I never tried to articulate how I did it. And the answer that fell out of my mouth was, I take on projects that I think I can add value to. So a lot of times we sat down with a couple of them and they laid out their business plan and said, what do I do? And they were so close to doing it on their own. They didn't need money. They didn't need more opportunities. They didn't need technical help. They needed nothing except for someone to say, yep, right track, keep going. So if you need a cheerleader, you need someone just to tell you you're all right and, you know, put the green light, the wave the green flag. I mean, I'd be more than happy to tell you that you're close. If you're going to say that I'm on the negative side or the positive side, I am way more optimistic when it comes to possibility, but I'm very critical over the obstacles, so that if you say something's not working, we will find the obstacle. Sometimes it's you're not putting enough time in. Sometimes your product's inferior. Sometimes you don't have enough money. Sometimes you need more customers. I mean, there's going to be a reason. But once you've identified, you don't keep your gaze on it. You put it on the list of things to conquer, and you keep grinding away until you've eliminated everything that's possible to eliminate. But you can't like have obstacles that are obvious and then claim that, you know, you can't scale or whatever. And there's a couple reoccurring ones. The biggest one is usually you'll have somebody who has a skill set, and they'll decide either on their own that they break away from where they were working and just go off and do it on their own, or they get laid off or fired and they decide that they're going to go off on their own. Well, right away, you have needs where you've got to make money. And then so a practitioner and business owner is the most common story that we see. So if woodworking and you go right in and start doing woodworking, you max yourself out and do all your production and sell it. The successful people, usually what will happen was they'll get stuck in the job of that business rather than the growth and the ownership of that business. And so, you know, what after you get a couple business owning, management under your belt, you can do both for a period of time, but once you get maxed out, you got to do both. I mean, you've got to segment out your day and do both. And it's hard for people, especially out of need, to play both roles, because if they're sitting idle working on their business, they're not making money. And if they're not making money, they can't pay their bills. And so what I'm asking you to do is an impossibility of math. And so I usually, now when I start a new company, I have to make sure that it survives without me putting practice into it. Like I can go and do some of the work, but it's got to be surviving without me as the sole practicer. So if I put a paid employee in the spot, it's got to be able to succeed on the balance sheet without me donating time into. And that's just one of my requirements. But the first one, you don't really have that luxury. It's got to pay the bills, and it's more like you work yourself up to 100%, and then through attrition, you sort of like leech off or break off and create some either part-time work for a new employee, or if we did it. I mean, when I created a full-time position on what I was doing, I mean, there were some times that money was really tight because employee comes first, I come second. So when the cash flow comes through, payroll comes out of that first, and then I get to keep whatever's left over after that. And there were some really slim times early on. So there was some preparation that had to go in. And not many realize that how much responsibility as an employer, when I take you on as an employee, I got to make sure that I can cover you, because it's not okay you quit your job and you come work for me, and then I find out that maybe you're a little bit too hard to afford, and so I got to let you go, where you gave up some place that was maybe paid you less than you wanted, but at least it was consistent. And now where you're at, you're left hanging dry. So we take that extremely serious, that if someone breaks off and dedicates themselves to us, that we are prepared enough to see it through and make sure that we can, cover them for what we promised. Okay. So there was a bunch of questions after last show that came in, and I want to answer those before they get buried in new questions. So let me bring that up real quick. The first question was about company naming. And by the way, 330-333-1570 if you want to text me here, or you can call 330-729-8255. 9977 if you want to call. And so this question was naming of your company. How do you come up with the name of a company? Well, all of the enterprises that we've done have been really super simple. I have this theory. You pick where you're from, Youngstown, and what do you do? Computer, right? Really easy. You don't have to get too clever to piece that stuff together. So Youngstown, where I'm from, makerspace, what I do. Youngstown, where I'm from, studio, what I do. So all of these companies have fielded that out. Now, what started the whole thing was I had to make sure that the companies that I was choosing had resources, like web resources that were available. They had Facebook pages and domain names, and all of that was available. So there was a couple of early ideas that maybe hit my theme but didn't match up with being available. So I would have to keep going. Now, a lot of people take inspirational things in naming, where something that's meaningful to them, they build into the name. And so where it's meaningful to them, it's not quite clear from the customer's end or the market's end what you do. And so, you know, you might wake up every day, look at your name, and it inspires you to go to work, but it might not lend itself that when someone comes across your name or sees the sign on the street that knows even what you do. So you got to be pretty clear. If you're not clear in name, then you have to spend some money to educate the consumers on what the heck it is that you do, because that would be a shame where you got the best detailing shop in the world and your sign says, you know, Bob's Infinity, right? And maybe Bob knows what infinity means, but maybe nobody else does, and they don't connect it to be in a detail shop, and then so you don't get people inquiring what you do, and I don't know, it just kind of works against you at some point. Again, it's, you know, I like simplicity, but you also have to go with, it has to be catchy, it has to be recognizable. There's a couple of names that are sort of a provocative or controversial that make you, you know, kind of stand out. People notice you because they have to take a second look at your stuff. Or, you know, if it's appealing to, you know, a certain industry, you might have to follow a theme of that industry, where car dealers have to do a certain thing, and, you know, lawyers have a certain theme. And so picking your name is important when you compare it to what everybody else is doing in that industry. Because if you go off and go in a different direction, the market has conditioned consumers in a certain way. To have certain expectations on how those types of businesses present themselves. And if you just do what everybody else does, it's easy because now you benefit from, you know, conforming to what's already been established. If you break off, now it's up to you to create a new, new information to the market. It's just sometimes a little bit more expensive, but you got to weigh it, like, what's more expensive? You having to spend the dollars to tell your story, or you being diluted into this, just another one of the same that's in the market, and, you know, everything in between. So that I get that question pretty often about naming, and you know, especially the creative types. They use their cleverness and their imagination to come up with really good names. And sometimes I've even changed some of the company names that were just not great and didn't tell enough, and maybe I wasn't good enough at telling the story, and so I had to, you know, change things up a little bit. So in the naming, but thank you for that question. But be sure to do your due diligence and make sure that it's not a registered name with the state. Make sure that, or the state that you're going to be participating in, make sure that you have domain availability on the web. You can go to GoDaddy and do a Whois lookup to make sure that it's not an owned domain. And then, you know, Facebook pages. A lot of times that Facebook pages have sort of like a keyword that you can grab, that when people search it, it tags with you. And if the one that makes it super easy isn't available, then you might want to pick something else. I know on Twitter, our Youngstown computer is just entirely too long. There's not, they don't allow keywords that are as many letters as Youngstown computer is. So we had to go like Y-Town computer or something of that nature. We had to shorten it. And so all of our keywords are the same except for that one. And it's kind of annoying to me. I wish I would have like taken Twitter a little bit more serious in the beginning, but I was never really on board much with using it as a marketing force. I was more, you know, Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn. And so I did, you know, I think Twitter was always a little more hostile than where I wanted to be. There wasn't, you know, I'd put a question out trying to help somebody and they were being more snark than actual people that were interested in learning something. So I shied away from it quite a bit. But anyway, So that I hope that answers your question. Thank you for it. And again, 330-729-9977, or you can text me at 333-1570. Okay, let's see. This one is out about a retail product, whether or not a brick-and-mortar store should be opened or an online version of it, being that retail customers have not quite gotten back to shopping in person. That's a great question, because you can use the current situation to maybe delay a little bit the brick and mortar. Now, good thing is, if you've got the cash, this is the perfect time to pick your, you got choice of any retail location ever. I mean, I've never seen so many closed brick and mortars around. So if when I got into business, I had to be choosy about where there was, because I mean, 224 was just about packed, where it was hard to find some place that was open. And if something was open, then you had to do some work on it, and it wasn't, the prime locations. Now you kind of got to pick. I'll answer that question a little bit more thorough when we get back from this break. 330-729-9977. You can text me at 333-1570. You're listening to the Bottom Line Business Show on 570 WKBN. I'll be back. All right. Welcome back, everybody. This is the Bottom Line Business Show. I am Joe Danier, owner of Youngstown Computer and a bunch of other businesses around town. My goal is to help small businesses sort of get started. The advent of this show was that we were doing it anyway, but this is a very public way to do this so that maybe someone more passive has a more passive version of sitting down at the table with me. Here you get to see me or hear me talk about these things that we're doing in real time. Maybe learn from some of the processes and some of the questions that other people will have. It's just a cool way to be able to absorb this stuff without it being an intimidating process. So that is the goal. Last question that came in was whether or not they should have a retail product and open a retail shop versus doing an online store. The first part of the question was if you've got the cash to be able to pick your retail location now, why you've got tons of availability, you might want to pull the trigger. Over in Struthers, we were going to open the makerspace, and I told the landlord, if the suite next to Youngstown Computer was ever available, it's a standing order, we will take it if it becomes available. Well, it became available, and I wasn't quite ready to get anything in there, so I have to wait 2 or 3 months before I got my stuff in order so that I can, do an opening on it. But it would I had a preference that I didn't want to lose it. I passed on it one time, and I thought I was not going to get it back. So I took advantage of now that there is availability to take a hold of that, because I'm going to make some really good use out of it in the future. And with our operations, we can definitely cash flow projects like that. But if money's tight and you're not well capitalized, you don't want to waste the money on a retail space if you can't see attracting customers to leave their house and their homes, especially if it's if you open a business where you're selling a product that is as a requirement for life or happiness and something someone truly would leave their house for. If you have sort of like a product that isn't a necessity to life and that's more of a convenience or something, it's a premium, it might be a little bit harder to get people out there. So that's the first part of my answer. But it would be, and there is a third option, by the way. If you have a retail product and you don't necessarily have the skill set or the experience with putting stuff online, which it's really easy to do, but if you don't have comfort in that, you can always pursue some consignment. So take somebody who's got some space, and here's what this does. So if you have somebody who maybe a retail space would lend itself to your product, and it's a small business and they control what's on their shelves, or it might be even a medium-sized business and you still might be able to wiggle your way in and get some shelf space. That a lot of the small businesses, I mean, they would be all over that, because your product, you're obviously going to want people to come to their store specifically for your product. So if all they have to do is give you, a couple shelves to sell your stuff on consignment, where they're even making some money for you being there, and you driving people to their store that might, become their customers, I mean, that's kind of like a overall win. So you might want to even consider that as being something a little bit more creative, that's halfway between you doing mail order shipping and whatever. I'll tell you, I've done both. I've done retail and I've done mail order. And I tell you that I was much better at retail than I was mail order, right? Because it, you know, you're dependent on so many other things happening. One of the mail order companies that I started was a pet supply, where we had these silkworms that we would breed and raise and package and then send out to the pets industry. Well, they were going out through shipping services, and so there was a lot of things out of my control that would happen to my stuff that was, you know, out there in the, you know, out there in the shipping process. And it created a little stress, because being when it's out of my control, I can't really do anything except for be sorry and ship another product. And it's part of the game, so it's not something you can avoid. But with local pickup and people coming to your store, you know, I think I could deal with individuals that are sitting in front of me a little bit better, and it just goes along with my skill set a little bit more. So anyway, I hope that answered your question. So you got three options. You got take advantage of lots of availability and find a spot that maybe otherwise would be harder to when things rebound. Do something with consignment and find a retailer that might give you some shelf space. You might have to pay a monthly fee. They just might do it and split the proceeds with you. I mean, the terms are up to you. You get to talk with them and find out what's important to them. You don't have to take first offer. There's probably more than one that are in our community. If one person wants to charge you and somebody else doesn't, you know, that might be your better alternative. But whoever has the biggest draw and can sell your products, I mean, I foresee that you probably do both. You probably do mail order, and maybe you go after consignment. I don't necessarily think you need to just limit yourself to one. But if you do the mail order, you can either do the entire operation internally, where you create a website, you create a product database, you process your own credit cards, and you do your own shipping, right? And so you own end-to-end, and then you have to market end-to-end. You have to make people aware that your website's there. You have to pay for all of the stuff, right? Now, if you're not good at that, you can tag team with somebody else's quote-unquote shopping cart. You know, Amazon's probably your best partner for exposure, but probably your worst partner for the margin that you have to give up. And so they will sell some stuff for you, no doubt, because people are, you know, people are conditioned. You won't have to get people to your site. You just become part of a huge product index, but you give up, you know, a percentage of your margin because of that sale. And in some of your cases, you don't have much margin in there in the first place, so it doesn't offer itself to everyone. But they're a consideration. So again, you can either join someone else's product database or you could just do yours from scratch and be responsible for getting people that, but you own the whole sale when you own end to end. So whichever you're good at. So those are three goods. That was a really good question. And again, I don't think I've quite ever explained it like that. So thank you for drawing that out the way that you did, because I think that's helpful contextually, like even like where we're at right now in this economic cycle, that truly is the consideration. So, all right, we're going to take another break. 330-729-9977. You can text me at 333-1570. You're listening to the Bottom Line Business Show here on 570 WKBM. I'll be back. Welcome back, everybody. This is the Bottom Line Business Show. I am Joe Danier. I'm your host. We talk about things that are happening with business and answer questions all program long. Maybe you have some inquiries about what you've got going on. We had a couple of significant calls last week. Our area has a big time shortage of rental houses, and so the need to create some. Not low cost, but some things that maybe bring more the you know, single moms and you know, sort of middle income owners or middle income earners into it. The rental rates have gotten to the point where it's sort of like outpriced a lot of our people, and people are struggling to find rentals. So anyway, big demand on that. We had a lot of investment from outside the state come in, bought a lot of homes, and some of the rental prices inflated a little bit. And so we're going to try to do some flipping. And as I said earlier in the program, one of my requirements for doing investments is that I have to be able to add value to whatever I'm touching. And so if I buy a house, I've got to figure out how I have a skill set or an ability to make whatever I buy more valuable, so that it's an investment. You know, none of this stuff is project where, you know, I got to keep being able to do this, and able to keep doing this is to make things more valuable, more profitable, so I can pour more and more value forward. And so that's a little bit of a task we're going to do over the next couple months into the next couple years, is we're going to buy some homes, and then we're going to use some of the homes that we're flipping, and we're going to think of like a cutaway where, if you want to know how something works, you cut it away to see what's on the inside of the walls and what's behind things. And so we're going to use some of our flips to do demonstrations for training people how to do that as well. Because I figure if we do it, then there's some other people that maybe the only thing keeping them out is that they just don't know how to do it. So like everything else we do it publicly. And we show people that they can do it too. The makerspace is just that. If we make a t-shirt, show you how to make a t-shirt and see if you can go make some money doing some t-shirts. So turn all a bunch of talent loose and see what, you know, what shakes out. I wonder, like, whenever I'm given an opportunity to do something, I wonder how many people, if given the same opportunity, would just light bulbs and lightning would flash when given it to. And that's what I want to do. I want to find people who are the only thing stopping them right now is that they just can't come across enough opportunities to, you know, work their magic. So, again, I'm on that, that's sort of like one of my biggest goals in the Youngstown area. Is I'm a lifer. I'm loyal to this area, and I want to see it develop and grow and keep jobs and grow jobs and make property values go up and make our schools even more solid and just making sure that talent is retained and people are retained. And, you know, these great educations that we're creating at YSU and all of our high schools are I don't want to see them flee into other markets. I mean, it's great that kids are going and making money in other markets, but I want kids to be able to make money here in our market. That's how we get stronger. And we are blessed with a lot of great infrastructure and great work ethic. We can do a lot of stuff. And I think sometimes it just needs some mentoring. So if any of you maybe have been down the road before in business and you just want to take a hold of someone who's getting their start and want to help them get going, I mean, please, we need you. They need you more than ever. So 330-729-9977. So a lot of the questions, it seems like I watched sort of themes, and when we first started doing this show, there was a lot of like really newbie questions, right? Like people that you can tell they built birdhouses or cornhole boards or something that is a hobby, and they know that they can do this on a bigger level, maybe a little bit more professional, but they were mostly side hustles, right? And I'm a big believer in the side hustle. I think that everyone can find a little bit more financial security if they, while they do their day job, they start developing other alternative skills that they can be doing just in case. What if they wanted to fall right, you know, they discover their passion and they figure they want to do that for 8 hours a day rather than their full-time gig. I think it's a shame that a lot of people, serve the whole entire working life doing something that fulfills somebody else's passion and not theirs. And so maybe we split a couple people off and have them pursue some of these other things. But anyway, that's what I'd like to see is some of these things go out of the garage and become like, okay, I know how to do this, but how do I do this as a business? Because all of you who do that make the exact same mistakes. You make the same tax mistakes. You make the same hiring mistakes. You make the same financial mistakes. And it's not, you don't have to be embarrassed about it. It's part of the not knowing part of it. Where do you learn this stuff? You go to the School of Hard Knocks and you make the mistake and you pay the consequence and then you learn from it and now you know. Well, I've just made just about every mistake. So I'm a good teacher on exactly what not to do. Even if I don't tell you what to do, if I could just tell you what not to do, you can find your way through the rest of it because the rest of it's kind of intuitive, right? It's easy. You find someone that has a demand or you make someone have a demand. You create a demand. And then you fill that demand and you offer more service than they have to pay for. So then they want to keep doing that and making that exchange. There you go. Rest of it's just gravy. 330-729-9977. And we had a couple shows ago, we had someone who was in the banking industry in wondering why we don't, you know, suggest more loans or debt taking on. And I spent more time thinking about a response to that because I think my initial response was not great. And I think the next show, my response was not great. And I want to keep sort of prodding at this until I'm 100% satisfactory that I do believe what I'm saying. And you know, I'm a risk calculator, right? And anything I can do to keep my risk low while I'm feeling something out gives me the absolute best chance of something being successful. I don't want to create a reason for something not working out. And it's not that I'm pessimistic. If you're around me for more than 10 minutes, you know that I'm an optimist guy. So I'm not looking and saying that every opportunity is going to fail, right? I just, it's an absolute certainty that some of them are going to fail. And it's still my response that if I create debt attached to something that has a failure attached to it, am I going to want to continue paying for that failure? Because I still owe it, even if it goes bust, right? I bought the equipment and still goes bust. And so I'm very debt averse. So saying it a third time here, I think that I truly am, even though I'm not against people finding funding, I would probably go after more, you know, private funding, somebody who is sharing the risk with you without, you know, like it's not a good partnership. If you fail, you lose, but you're the only one that loses. A fair partnership is it's shared risk. So if I give you money and you put in money and it loses, we both lose. If it wins, we both wins. And I think that's pretty fair because, you know, then I feel my partner sort of has sort of a little bit of skin in the game and, you know, not just taking a chunk out of the successes. But again, yeah, I'm pretty certain that take on, and there's certain industries that you absolutely need to buy machinery and vehicles and, you know, real estate, and there's some capital that is necessary. But I'm just telling you that I like to prove out that I'm capable of having received orders and pipeline before I take on debt. And so maybe establishing it for a year or so, proving that you can make money doing it, and then take on just enough of the debt that you need to. Don't get over ambitious and take on more than you can handle, because you could get suffocated. And I don't want, you know, there are enough factors working against you in business. You don't want one of them being the pressures of owing debt or making a payment. When if you slow grow it a little bit more, it'll bring a little bit of confidence to, you know, bring your confidence to your operation. So yeah, I'm by my third time, I'm not against it, but I would prefer you work a little bit slower and go out of cash flow a little bit and maybe take on some private money rather than public money. I mean, your banker, you know, is your friend. And here's the reality though. So I've done some inquiries about how, you know, the banking relationships are done. And, you know, you watch a movie and you walk into the room and everybody's in line with the banker and you sit down and you actually talk to the underwriter and whatever. It's just not like that anymore. Like, paper gets dumped off to a mathematical process somewhere. So I don't really necessarily see that you could ever plead your case on your business plan in front of the person who's actually going to take on your loan. So again, I'm a little bit down, you know, talking down to traditional fund lending, but it's more on the so of risk being debt averse rather than risk, or rather, not creating fund or traditional institutions as a, you know, as a partner. This question came up a bunch too, and it's in the same vein, partnerships and whether or not you should take on partnerships, especially if some of the partners are bringing some cash to the table. And this sort of is the same thing. This presents a little bit of risk because, I mean, partnerships are sort of like marriages. And, you know, I just fielded an email from someone who I had instructed, you know, I gave him the advisement that he should probably not enter a partnership the way that they had it structured. There was a more meaningful way of doing it. And his complaint now was that he's doing about 75 to 80% of the work, and he's only, he only gets to realize the benefits about 50%. So he's a 50-50 partner in something that he's doing about 80% of the work. And it's hard because no matter which side of it you're on, you're always going to feel like you're pulling more of the weight than the other person. And that's just part of the gig. I mean, where somebody might be doing the physical exercise, the other one might be doing the contacts. And how do you make a
a math formula to compare to make sure that you're putting in equal stuff. The guy who's brought his contacts to the table or signed the order books feels like he's bringing, you wouldn't have the orders without him. So the weight is equal in his head. And that's why it creates those conflicts, because if you don't hash out what a shared sort of like investment would be, then you're always going to feel like you're bringing more to the table. So what I suggest in one of the partnerships that I'm putting together now is that we're running into that home and structure improvement company. I will never lift a hammer, right? And so if there's a contractor that is involved, like my partner in it is an actual contractor. So if I'm not going to lift a hammer, I don't expect him to lift a hammer unless I can figure out a way of getting an analog that equals my responsibility in that hammer and make it equal. And you've got to keep talking through that until the things you say are not only sound good and can be agreed on, but you can put it on paper so you know exactly if-then statements. If this happens, then this happens. If this happens, and then that happens. So that's a way to make it equal. But again, this is like a marriage. So you go into it maybe being, you know, awesome to each other, but what happens if somebody goes through some struggle in their marriage, or they get a gambling addiction, or that they are start getting addicted to drugs, and you lose part of the person who was necessary in the operations, and then they can't stick to their part of building the business? Because remember, this isn't like a one-year marriage. I mean, these are long-term commitments that you make in business. I mean, I am so glad I had probably 15 opportunities along the way of the first company, Youngstown Computer, for bringing in partners. And early on, it was really attractive to bring in other partners because there was a lot of lifting I was doing, and I was way out of my comfort zone. I was way out of my pay grade, right? And I didn't take any of them. And now I'm super thankful, because I probably would have very little ownership of these enterprises, because they, you know, people were bringing money and people were bringing, you know, customers, but they weren't bringing doing the work. And I would have really hated the fact that other people were sharing in to the revenue now, when the company really, I mean, what would happen? Our order books are full. Our pipeline is absolutely full. If we were still in those deals where I didn't need any more customers and I didn't need any cash, right, they're 30% or they're 50% of operations, they would literally be taking 50% of the revenue and would not have to do anything. So your needs will then change. What you think your biggest struggle in now might not be your biggest struggle 5 years from now. So you got to understand, you're locked in to that, satisfying that need, even if that need is no more. So you have to do a lot of lot of imagination and role playing and rehearsing to what this will become and how that's going to be handled. I'm telling you, dialogue is your best bet. If you can just talk through where people are coming from and put out hypotheticals and get to know how they'd respond, and you put that down on paper, then all you got to do is follow your roadmap as things go. So if it goes to plan, your roadmap's absolutely correct. So the better you're at guessing, then the easier it's going to be if you hit those kind of pitfalls. But I've seen drug abuse. That was drug abuse and gambling is the number one. The partner gets they find success. They were both putting in 40 hours. One of them gets an issue. They're putting in 20 hours. The other one's not. The other one doesn't know how many the other's putting in, and then they realize it, and it's just not pretty. And I don't want you to, you know, I don't want you to get stuck with a bad partnership deal. So the best way of doing it is two people operating their own companies that just do cooperative work that has a sunset, that if somebody doesn't pull their weight, you can pull the plug on that cooperation and move that cooperation to somebody else. So in our case, one guy's going to be bringing one asset, I'm going to bring the other asset, and I already know that if that person can't bring the asset anymore, it goes away. It's not a permanent partnership, and I don't put anything inside the partnership that glues us together permanently. The partnership is only the practice of that thing that's in the pipeline, and having, you know, being able to do, like, if we stopped operations right now, I'd know exactly where to divide, because I keep it completely. I know what I brought to the table, I know what he brought to the table, and I don't ever try to claim his, and he don't ever try to claim mine. And it keeps everybody honest. All right, 330-729-9977. Let's start a call with Joe. I might have to take a break in between this, but Joe, you're on the Bottom Line Business Show. How can I help you?
Joe.
Yes.
How you doing?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
Pretty good. Hey, I got a business proposition that I'm going to be encountering today. It's the Kentucky Derby. I was wondering about my degree of risk on some of these horses here.
It's probably way more risk than you should take. Are you good at gambling? Are you good at betting?
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty good. I've been betting horses for about probably about 40 years.
All right. Do you take an underdog or do you take the favorite?
Well, I tell you what. The favorite is Essential Quality, who won the Bluegrass Stakes. And he's the favorite. He's like 2-1. But a horse that was in the Bluegrass Stakes finished second. He lost by a head. And his name is, man, there's 20 horses in this race. Highly motivated. He only lost by a neck. And he lost by a neck to Essential Quality. And this horse is like 12-13-1.
You know, I usually pick on the names, so Highly Motivated is probably where I'd put my bet.
You know what? You just answered my question. I'm going to bet Highly Motivated.
Woo! Yes! Yes, Joe. Thank you.
All right, Joe.
All right, take care. I wish you luck. I hope you have good betting luck on the Kentucky Derby. And I did forget that was today, so I hope Joe's successful with his Highly Motivated. And now I get to cheer on a horse in the Kentucky Derby because I feel like I got a stake in it. I'll tell you that I did like going down and doing horses down at that place down south. And when they brought cards and all that kind of stuff, I was pretty good at gambling because I was real good at math. So counting cards and blackjack was really my thing. But it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work gambling. So those of you who do it and love it and whatever, God bless you. All right, we'll come back. 330-729-9977. You can text 333-1570. You're listening to the Bottom Line Business Show here on 570 WKBN. I'll be back. All right. Welcome, everybody. This is the Bottom Line Business Show. This is a good show. I like these very varied questions, sort of like early on questions and sort of like middle questions and then some advanced questions. This audience is made up of everybody who's just getting started and people who have done this, 100 times over. All of it is super important. I love getting seasoned people engaged because I think you got brains in here that just, there aren't many people to share about this kind of stuff. So we set up this stage to dump our knowledge on, the next generation. And I will pick this out. Like I went through a series of fears here. So when I first started, I got into business at around 19 years old, all the way up through my 30s, all the business owners that I met and did business with and were customers, they were in their 50s plus. No new business owners or no people who are participating like I was, I couldn't see them in any direction. Now, I don't know that they weren't. Maybe I was in the wrong paths. Maybe I was just pursuing the older groups, the older demographic, but I didn't see them. And I got afraid that when people started retiring and needing to get out, so I know family successions don't go good or don't go well. Maybe sell-offs don't go any better, but at least I would like to see the next generation be replaced by young blood, people with new ideas and will innovate rather than somebody goes out of business. And I remember driving down 46 and a business was for sale for the longest time. And then one day I drove by and it just said closed, right? And so I assume that they couldn't find a buyer and they didn't want to stick it out and keep doing business. So the retirement was basically taking a company and wiping it off the total map. And that kind of broke my heart a little bit because I know how much effort it takes to get one going. So to let one be extinguished, I kind of took that a little bit on the personal side. So, even if the next generation of entrepreneurs get good at picking up and, seceding, is that it? Yeah, succession, seceding the previous owner and bringing new life to a corporation, right? I don't know how many companies would offload their company to you and just make sure that it survived without having, it takes sometimes a lot of money. A lot of these business owners ask a lot of money, but what's the alternative? They're asking $1 million for their company versus just closing it down and letting it go away. I mean, doesn't seem like it's a, you know, if it's on the market for a while and you're just going to close it down anyway, what risk would it be of handing it off to someone who maybe gives you 25% of revenues every year and then at least get something? If it goes bust, that's where it was going anyway. But if it doesn't, it's out there. So, but what I started seeing before 2019 hit, and I saw a lot of younger people making pitches and starting companies, and I was impressed with the level of thought. And so that locally here, we're making some entrepreneurs that know what they're doing. There's a couple of the pitches that had I been in the position to take on something new, I would have been all over, because they were modeled well. They had great research. They had great proof of concept. I mean, they were like a, you know, put a quarter in and pull the lever, and this thing was go time. And I just hope that the spirit of entrepreneurs in this area will get there again, where there'll be so many ideas that we just need more people to get them kicked off. And what I don't like to see is when the marketplace gets defensive, when people are afraid to share their ideas because they're afraid they're going to get stolen or sniped. And then so you have a bunch of people that have good ideas that they can't start them themselves, and they're afraid somebody else is going to start them. So these good ideas just die on the vine, and I hate that as well. So that's sort of my hope here, that if maybe I could inspire some of the more defensive ones, give you some a little bit more confidence, you'll be more likely to be able to share things out. But you know how many times, like I went out to the market one time, and all I wanted to do was I needed a circuit designed. And so I went out to people who did circuits, and I just wanted to pay somebody for a circuit design. And I got a lot of pushback on this deal, where I thought I was just going to go, somebody, you know, needed some extra money and I needed something designed. They were very defensive about their expertise, and they weren't just going to sell it to me because all I was going to do is profit from it. And so they wouldn't just sell me the circuit without partnering in on the use of that circuit in other products. And I understand sometimes in sort of that space there that you got to be defensive because your stuff is sellable and you just don't want to give it away when you can have it. But it was weird because I didn't really consider the circuit that needed to be designed that was going to be sort of like globe changing. So it was weird to me how defensive that the use of somebody else's design, even if purchased outright, was going to be, you know, frowned upon. So I learned that real quick, and I haven't asked for that. But copywriters are the same thing. People with artistic and stuff like that, they get defensive, and I hate that for us. I wish people were just more open and allowed that ability. But you kind of see from their side, I bet you they get exploited quite a bit. And you know, somebody takes a design, paid $100 for it, and goes off and makes $50 million, and that happens to you one time. And guess what you do the next time someone wants a circuit design for you? Yeah, you're a little defensive too. But anyway, this was a good show. I liked the level of questions, and I liked the Joe called about the Kentucky Derby. I hope that all of you who are watching the ponies have some good success with whomever you've selected. Stay tuned here. We're going to come back with the Youngstown Computer Show. We'll talk about some things in technology. 330-729-9977 is the phone number, 333-1570. You can queue up your computer calls for the next segment. Thanks again. We'll be right back with the Youngstown Computer Show here on 570 WKBN.